to Harry as if hoping somebody was going to shout, "April Fool!" When nobody did, he opened his mouth yet again, but was spared the struggle to find more words by the arrival of the third owl of the evening, which zoomed through the still open window like a feathery cannonball and landed with a clatter on the kitchen table, causing all three of the Dursleys to jump with fright. Harry tore a second official-looking envelope from the owl's beak and ripped it open as the owl swooped back out into the night.
"Enough effing owls!"
muttered Uncle Vernon, distractedly, stumping over to the window and slamming it shut again.
"Dear Mr. Potter, further to our letter of approximately 22 minutes ago, the Ministry of Magic has revised its decision to destroy your wand forthwith. You may retain your wand until your disciplinary hearing on 12th August, at which time an official decision will be taken. Following discussions with the headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, the Ministry has agreed that the question of your expulsion will also be decided at that time. You should therefore consider yourself suspended from school, pending further inquiries. With best wishes, yours sincerely, Mafalda Hopkirk, Improper Use of Magic Office, Ministry of Magic."
Harry read this letter through 3 times in quick succession. The miserable knot in his chest loosened slightly at the thought that he was not definitely expelled, though his fears were by no means banished. Everything seemed to hang on this hearing on the 12th of August.
"Well,"
said Uncle Vernon, recalling Harry to his surroundings,
"what now? Have they sentenced you to anything? Do your lot have the death penalty?"
he added as a hopeful afterthought. "I've got to go to a hearing," said Harry.
"And they'll sentence you there?"
"I suppose so."
"I won't give up hope, then,"
said Uncle Vernon nastily. "Well, if that's all," said Harry, getting to his feet. He was desperate to be alone, to think, perhaps to send a letter to Ron, Hermione, or Sirius.
"No, it ruddy well is not all," bellowed Uncle Vernon. "Sit back down."
"What now?" said Harry impatiently.
"Dudley!" roared Uncle Vernon. "I want to know exactly what happened to my son."
"Fine!" yelled Harry, and in his temper red and gold sparks shot out of the end of his wand, still clutched in his hand. All three Dursleys flinched, looking terrified. "Dudley and I were in the alleyway between Magnolia Crescent and Wisteria Walk," said Harry, speaking fast, fighting to control his temper. "Dudley thought he'd be smart with me. I pulled out my wand, but didn't use it. Then 2 Dementors turned up."
"But what are Dementoids?"
asked Uncle Vernon furiously.
"What do they do?"
"I told you, they suck all the happiness out of you," said Harry. "And if they get the chance, they kiss you."
"Kiss you?"
said Uncle Vernon, his eyes popping slightly.
"Kiss you?"
"It's what they call it when they suck the soul out of your mouth." Aunt Petunia uttered a soft scream.
"His soul! They didn't take... He's still got his..."
She seized Dudley by the shoulders and shook him, as though testing to see whether she could hear his soul rattling around inside him.
"Of course they didn't get his soul. You'd know if they had,"
said Harry, exasperated.
"Fought 'em off, did you, son?"
said Uncle Vernon loudly, with the appearance of a man struggling to bring the conversation back onto a plane he understood.
"Gave 'em the old one too, did you?"
"You can't give a Dementor the old one too," said Harry through clenched teeth.
"Why's he all right then?" blustered Uncle Vernon. "Why isn't he all empty then?"
"Because I use the Patronus.
Whoosh!"
With a clattering, a whirring of wings, and a soft fall of dust, a fourth owl came shooting out of the kitchen fireplace.
"For God's sake!"
roared Uncle Vernon, pulling great clumps of hair out of his moustache, something he hadn't been driven to in a long time.
"I will not have owls here! I will not tolerate this, I tell you!"
But Harry was already pulling a roll of parchment from the owl's leg. He was so convinced that this letter had to be from Dumbledore, explaining everything, the Dementors, Mrs. Fig, what the Ministry was up to, how he, Dumbledore, intended to sort everything out, that for the first time in his life, he was disappointed to see Sirius's handwriting. Ignoring Uncle Vernon's ongoing rant about owls, and narrowing his eyes against a second cloud of dust as the most recent owl took off back up the chimney, Harry read Sirius's message. Arthur's just told us what's happened. Don't leave the house again, whatever you do. Harry found this such an inadequate response to everything that had happened tonight that he turned the piece of parchment over, looking for the rest of the letter, but there was nothing there. And now his temper was rising again. Wasn't anybody going to say well done for fighting off two Dementors single-handedly? Both Mr. Weasley and Sirius were acting as though he'd misbehaved, and they were saving their tellings off until they could ascertain how much damage had been done.
A peck! I mean, pack of owls shooting in and out of my house, and I won't have it, boy, I won't!
I can't stop the owls coming, Harry snapped, crushing Sirius's letter in his fist.
I want the truth about what happened tonight, barked Uncle Vernon. If it was Demendus who hurt Dudley, how come you've been expelled? You did, you know what, you've admitted it.
Harry took a deep, steadying breath. His head was beginning to ache again. He wanted more than anything to get out of the kitchen, away from the Dursleys. I did the Patronus charm to get rid of the Dementors, he said, forcing himself to remain calm. It's the only thing that works against them.
But what were Dementoids doing in Little Whinging? Said Uncle Vernon, in tones of outrage.
Couldn't tell you, said Harry wearily. No idea. His head was pounding in the glare of the strip lighting now. His anger was ebbing away. He felt drained, exhausted. The Dursleys were all staring at him.
It's you, said Uncle Vernon forcefully. It's got something to do with you, boy, I know it. Why else would they turn up here? Why else would they be down that alleyway? You've got to be the only...
Evidently he couldn't bring himself to say the word wizard.
The only you-know-what for miles.
I don't know why they were here. But at these words of Uncle Vernon's, Harry's exhausted brain ground back into action. Why had the Dementors come to Little Whinging? How could it be coincidence that they had arrived in the alleyway where Harry was? Had they been sent? Had the Ministry of Magic lost control of the Dementors? Had they deserted Azkaban and joined Voldemort, as Dumbledore had predicted they would?
These Demembers guard some weirdo's prison, said Uncle Vernon, lumbering in the wake of Harry's train of thought.
Yes, said Harry. If only his head would stop hurting, if only he could just leave the kitchen and get to his dark bedroom and think.
Aho! They were coming to arrest you, said Uncle Vernon, with the triumphant air of a man reaching an unassailable conclusion. That's it, isn't it, boy? You're on the run from the law.
Of course I'm not, said Harry, shaking his head as though to scare off a fly, his mind racing now.
Then why?
He must have sent them, said Harry quietly, more to himself than to Uncle Vernon.
What's that? Who must have sent them?
Lord Voldemort, said Harry. He registered dimly how strange it was that the Dursleys, who flinched, winced and squawked if they heard words like wizard, magic or wand, could hear the name of the most evil wizard of all time without the slightest tremor.
Lord, hang on, said Uncle Vernon, his face screwed up, a look of dawning comprehension in his piggy eyes. I've heard that name. That was the one who...
Murdered my parents. Yes, Harry said dully.
But he's gone,
said Uncle Vernon impatiently, without the slightest sign that the murder of Harry's parents might be a painful topic to anybody.
That giant bloke said so. He's gone.
He's back, said Harry heavily. It felt very strange to be standing here in Aunt Petunia's surgically clean kitchen, beside the top-of-the-range fridge and the widescreen television, and talking calmly of Lord Voldemort to Uncle Vernon. The arrival of the Dementors in Little Whinging seemed to have caused a breach in the great invisible wall that divided the relentlessly non-magical world of Privet Drive and the world beyond. Harry's two lives had somehow become fused, and everything had been turned upside down. The Dursleys were asking for details about the magical world, and Mrs. Fig knew Albus Dumbledore. Dementors were soaring around Little Whinging, and he might never go back to Hogwarts. Harry's head throbbed more painfully.
Back?
Whispered Aunt Petunia. She was looking at Harry as she had never looked at him before, And all of a sudden, for the very first time in his life, Harry fully appreciated that Aunt Petunia was his mother's sister. He could not have said why this hit him so very powerfully at this moment. All he knew was that he was not the only person in the room who had an inkling of what Lord Voldemort being back might mean. Aunt Petunia had never in her life looked at him like that before. Her large pale eyes, so unlike her sister's, were not narrowed in dislike or anger. They were wide and fearful. The furious pretense that Aunt Petunia had maintained all Harry's life, that there was no magic and no world other than the world she inhabited with Uncle Vernon, seemed to have fallen away. "Yes," Harry said, talking directly to Aunt Petunia now. "He came back a month ago. I saw him." Her hands found Dudley's massive leather-clad shoulders and clutched them.
"Hang on," said Uncle Vernon, looking from his wife to Harry and back again, apparently dazed and confused by the unprecedented understanding that seems to have sprung up between them. "Hang on. This Lord Voldy thing's back, you say?"
"Yes."
"The one who murdered your parents?"
"Yes."
"And now he's sending dismembers after you?"
"Looks like it," said Harry.
"I see,"
said Uncle Vernon, looking from his white-faced wife to Harry and hitching up his trousers. He seemed to be swelling, his great purple face stretching before Harry's eyes.
"Well, that settles it,"
he said, his shirt front straining as he inflated himself.
"You can get out of this house, boy."
"What?" said Harry.
"You heard me. Out!"
Uncle Vernon bellowed, and even Aunt Petunia and Dudley jumped.
"Out! Out! I should have done it years ago. Owls treating the place like a rest home, puddings exploding, half the lounge destroyed, Dudley's tail, Marge bobbing around on the ceiling, and that flying Ford Anglia. Out! Out! You've had it. Your history. You're not staying here if some loony's after you. You're not endangering my wife and son. You're not bringing trouble down on us. If you're going the same way as your useless parents, I've had it. Out!"
Harry stood rooted to the spot. The letters from the Ministry, Mr. Weasley and Sirius, were crushed in his left hand. "Don't leave the house again, whatever you do. Do not leave your aunt and uncle's house."
"You heard me,"
said Uncle Vernon, bending forward now so that his massive purple face came closer to Harry's, so that Harry actually felt flecks of spit hit his face.
"Get going. You were all keen to leave half an hour ago. I'm right behind you. Get out and never darken our doorstep again. Why we ever kept you in the first place, I don't know. Marge was right. It should have been the orphanage. We were too damn soft for our own good. Thought we could squash it out of you. Thought we could turn you normal. But you've been rotten from the beginning, and I've had enough. Owls!"
The fifth owl zoomed down the chimney so fast it actually hit the floor before zooming into the air again with a loud screech. Harry raised his hand to seize the letter, which was in a scarlet envelope, but it soared straight over his head, flying directly at Aunt Petunia, who let out a scream and ducked her arms over her face. The owl dropped the red envelope on her head, turned, and flew straight up the chimney again. Harry darted forward to pick up the letter, but Aunt Petunia beat him to it.
"You can open it if you like," said Harry, "but I'll hear what it says anyway. That's a howler."
"Let go of it, Petunia," roared Uncle Vernon. "Don't touch it. It could be dangerous."
"It's addressed to me," said Aunt Petunia in a shaking voice. "It's addressed to me, Vernon. Look, Mrs. Petunia Dursley, the kitchen, No. 4, Privet Drive."
She caught her breath, horrified. The red envelope had begun to smoke.
"Open it," Harry urged her. "Get it over with. It'll happen anyway."
"No."
Aunt Petunia's hand was trembling. She looked wildly around the kitchen as though looking for an escape route, but too late. The envelope burst into flames. Aunt Petunia screamed and dropped it. An awful voice filled the kitchen, echoing in the confined space, issuing from the burning letter on the table.
"Remember my last, Petunia."
Aunt Petunia looked as though she might faint. She sank into the chair beside Dudley, her face in her hands. The remains of the envelope smoldered into ash in the silence.
"What is this?"
Uncle Vernon said hoarsely.
"What? I don't... Petunia?"
Aunt Petunia said nothing. Dudley was staring stupidly at his mother, his mouth hanging open. The silence spiraled horribly. Harry was watching his aunt, utterly bewildered, his head throbbing fit to burst.
"Petunia, dear?"
said Uncle Vernon timidly.
Petunia?
She raised her head. She was still trembling. She swallowed.
The boy will have to stay, Vernon, she said weakly.
What?
He stays,
she said. She was not looking at Harry. She got to her feet again.
Petunia, if we throw him out, the neighbors will talk, she said.
She was regaining her usual brisk, snappish manner rapidly, though she was still very pale.
They'll ask awkward questions. They'll want to know where he's gone. We'll have to keep him.
Uncle Vernon was deflating like an old tire.
But Petunia, dear.
Aunt Petunia ignored him. She turned to Harry.
You're to stay in your room, she said. You're not to leave the house. Now, get to bed.
Harry didn't move.
Who was that howler from?
Don't ask questions, Aunt Petunia snapped.
Are you in touch with wizards?
I told you to get to bed.
What did it mean? Remember the last... what?
Go to bed.
How come...
You heard your aunt. Now get to bed.
Chapter 3 The Advance Guard. I've just been attacked by Dementors, and I might be expelled from Hogwarts. I want to know what's going on and when I'm going to get out of here. Harry copied these words onto three separate pieces of parchment the moment he reached the desk in his dark bedroom. He addressed the first to Sirius, the second to Ron, and the third to Hermione. His owl, Hedwig, was off hunting. Her cage stood empty on the desk. Harry paced the bedroom, waiting for her to come back, his head pounding, his brain too busy for sleep, even though his eyes stung and itched with tiredness. His back ached from carrying Dudley home, and the two lumps on his head where the window and Dudley had hit him were throbbing painfully. Up and down he paced, consumed with anger and frustration, grinding his teeth and clenching his fists, casting angry looks out at the empty star-strewn sky every time he passed the window. Dementors sent to get him. Mrs. Fig and Mundungus Fletcher tailing him in secret. Then suspension from Hogwarts, and a hearing at the Ministry of Magic, and still no one was telling him what was going on. And what had that howler been about? Whose voice had echoed so horribly, so menacingly through the kitchen? Why was he still trapped here without information? Why was everyone treating him like some naughty kid? Don't do any more magic, stay in the house. He kicked his school trunk as he passed it, but far from relieving his anger, he felt worse, as he now had a sharp pain in his toe to deal with in addition to the pain in the rest of his body. Just as he limped past the window, Hedwig soared through it with a soft rustle of wings like a small ghost. "About time," Harry snarled, as she landed lightly on top of her cage. "You can put that down, I've got work for you." Hedwig's large, round, amber eyes gazed reproachfully at him over the dead frog clamped in her beak. "Come here," said Harry, picking up the three small rolls of parchment and a leather thong and tying the scrolls to her scaly leg. "Take these straight to Sirius, Ron, and Hermione, and don't come back here without good long replies. Keep pecking them till they've written decent-length answers if you've got to. Understand?" Hedwig gave a muffled, hooting noise, beak still full of frog.
"Get going, then," said Harry.
She took off immediately. The moment she'd gone, Harry threw himself down onto his bed without undressing and stared at the dark ceiling. In addition to every other miserable feeling, he now felt guilty that he'd been irritable with Hedwig. She was the only friend he had at Number 4 Privet Drive. But he'd make it up to her when she came back with Sirius's, Ron's, and Hermione's answers. They were bound to write back quickly. They couldn't possibly ignore a Dementor attack. He'd probably wake up tomorrow to three fat letters full of sympathy and plans for his immediate removal to the Burrow. And with that comforting idea, sleep rolled over him, stifling all further thought. But Hedwig didn't return next morning. Harry spent the day in his bedroom, leaving it only to go to the bathroom.
Three times that day Aunt Petunia shoved food into his room through the cat flap Uncle Vernon had installed three summers ago. Every time Harry heard her approaching, he tried to question her about the howler, but he might as well have interrogated the doorknob for all the answers he got. Otherwise, the Dursleys kept well clear of his bedroom. Harry couldn't see the point of forcing his company on them. Another row would achieve nothing, except perhaps making him so angry he'd perform more illegal magic. So it went on for three whole days. Harry was filled alternately with restless energy that made him unable to settle to anything, during which he paced his bedroom again, furious at the whole lot of them for leaving him to stew in this mess, and with a lethargy so complete that he could lie on his bed for an hour at a time, staring dazedly into space, aching with dread at the thought of the ministry hearing. What if they ruled against him? What if he was expelled and his wand was snapped in half? What would he do? Where would he go? He could not return to living full-time with the Dursleys, not now that he knew the other world, the one to which he really belonged. Was it possible that he might be able to move into Sirius's house, as Sirius had suggested a year ago, before he had been forced to flee from the ministry himself? Would he be allowed to live there alone, given that he was still underage, or would the matter of where he went next be decided for him? Had his breach of the International Statute of Secrecy been severe enough to land him in a cell in Azkaban? Whenever this thought occurred, Harry invariably slid off his bed and began pacing again. On the fourth night after Hedwig's departure, Harry was lying in one of his apathetic phases, staring at the ceiling, his exhausted mind quite blank, when his uncle entered his bedroom. Harry looked slowly around at him. Uncle Vernon was wearing his best suit and an expression of enormous smugness.
"We're going out," he said.
"Sorry?"
That is to say, your aunt, Dudley, and I are going out.
"Fine," said Harry dully, looking back at the ceiling.
"You are not to leave your bedroom while we are away."
"Okay."
"You are not to touch the television, the stereo, or any of our possessions."
"Right."
"You are not to steal food from the fridge."
"Okay."
"I'm going to lock your door."
"You do that." Uncle Vernon glared at Harry, clearly suspicious of this lack of argument, then stomped out of the room and closed the door behind him. Harry heard the key turn in the lock and Uncle Vernon's footsteps walking heavily down the stairs. A few minutes later, he heard the slamming of car doors, the rumble of an engine, and the unmistakable sound of the car sweeping out of the drive. Harry had no particular feeling about the Dursleys leaving. It made no difference to him whether they were in the house or not. He could not even summon the energy to get up and turn on his bedroom light. The room grew steadily darker around him as he lay listening to the night sounds through the window he kept open all the time, waiting for the blessed moment when Hedwig returned. The empty house creaked around him. The pipes gurgled. Harry lay there in a kind of stupor, thinking of nothing, suspended in misery. And then, quite distinctly, he heard a crash in the kitchen below. He sat bolt upright, listening intently. The Dursleys couldn't be back, it was much too soon, and in any case he hadn't heard their car. There was silence for a few seconds, and then he heard voices. "Burglars," he thought, sliding off the bed onto his feet. But a split second later it occurred to him that burglars would keep their voices down, and whoever was moving around in the kitchen was certainly not troubling to do so. He snatched up his wand from his bedside table and stood facing his bedroom door, listening with all his might. Next moment he jumped as the lock gave a loud click and his door swung open. Harry stood motionless, staring through the open door at the dark upstairs landing, straining his ears for further sounds. But none came. He hesitated for a moment and then moved swiftly and silently out of his room to the head of the stairs. His heart shot upward into his throat. There were people standing in the shadowy hall below, silhouetted against the streetlight glowing through the glass door, 8 or 9 of them, all, as far as he could see, looking up at him.
"Lower your wand, boy, before you take someone's eye out," said a low, growling voice.
Harry's heart was thumping uncontrollably. He knew that voice, but he did not lower his wand. "Professor Moody?" he said uncertainly.
I don't know so much about Professor, growled the voice. Never got round to much teaching, did I? Get down here. We want to see you properly.
Harry lowered his wand slightly, but did not relax his grip on it, nor did he move. He had very good reason to be suspicious. He had recently spent 9 months in what he had thought was Mad-Eye Moody's company, only to find out that it wasn't Moody at all, but an imposter. An imposter, moreover, who had tried to kill Harry before being unmasked, but before he could make a decision about what to do next, a second, slightly hoarse voice floated upstairs.
"It's all right, Harry. We've come to take you away."
Harry's heart leapt. He knew that voice, too, although he hadn't heard it for more than a year.
"Professor Lupin?"
he said disbelievingly. "Is that you?"
"Why are we all standing in the dark?"
said a third voice, this one completely unfamiliar, a woman's.
"Lumos!"
A wand tip flared, illuminating the hall with magical light. Harry blinked. The people below were crowded around the foot of the stairs, gazing intently up at him, some craning their heads for a better look. Remus Lupin stood nearest to him. Though still quite young, Lupin looked tired and rather ill. He had more grey hair than when Harry had said goodbye to him, and his robes were more patched and shabbier than ever. Nevertheless, he was smiling broadly at Harry, who tried to smile back through his shock.
"Oh, he looks just like I thought he would,"
said the witch who was holding her lit wand aloft. She looked the youngest there. She had a pale, heart-shaped face, dark, twinkling eyes, and short, spiky hair that was a violent shade of violet.
"Whatcha, Harry?"
"Yeah, I see what you mean, Remus,"
said a bald black wizard standing farthest back. He had a deep, slow voice and wore a single gold hoop in his ear.
"He looks exactly like James."
"Except the eyes,"
said a wheezy-voiced, silver-haired wizard at the back.
"Lily's eyes."
Mad-Eye Moody, who had long grizzled grey hair and a large chunk missing from his nose, was squinting suspiciously at Harry through his mismatched eyes. One of the eyes was small, dark, and beady, the other large, round, and electric blue, the magical eye that could see through walls, doors, and the back of Moody's own head.
"Are you quite sure it's him, Lupin?" he growled. "It'd be a nice lookout if we bring back some Death Eater impersonating him. We ought to ask him something only the real Potter would know, unless anyone brought any Veritaserum."
"Harry, what form does your Patronus take?" said Lupin. "A stag," said Harry nervously.
"That's him, Mad-Eye,"
said Lupin. Harry descended the stairs, very conscious of everybody still staring at him, stowing his wand into the back pocket of his jeans as he came.
"Don't put your wand there, boy," roared Moody. "What if it ignited? Better wizards than you have lost buttocks, you know."
"Who do you know who's lost a buttock?"
the violet-haired woman asked Mad-Eye interestedly.
"Never you mind. You just keep your wand out of your back pocket," growled Mad-Eye. "Elementary wand safety. Nobody bothers about it anymore."
He stumped off toward the kitchen.
"And I saw that,"
he added irritably as the woman rolled her eyes at the ceiling. Lupin held out his hand and shook Harry's.
"How are you?"
he asked, looking at Harry closely.
Fine.
Harry could hardly believe this was real. 4 weeks with nothing, not the tiniest hint of a plan to remove him from Privet Drive, and suddenly a whole bunch of wizards was standing matter-of-factly in the house, as though this were a long-standing arrangement. He glanced at the people surrounding Lupin. They were still gazing avidly at him. He felt very conscious of the fact that he had not combed his hair for 4 days.
"You're really lucky the Dursleys are out," he mumbled.
"Lucky? Ha!"
said the violet-haired woman.
"It was me that lured them out of the way. Sent a letter by Muggle Post telling them they'd been shortlisted for the All England Best Kept Suburban Lawn competition. They're heading off to the prize-giving right now. Or they think they are."
Harry had a fleeting vision of Uncle Vernon's face when he realized there was no all-England best-kept suburban lawn competition.
"We are leaving, aren't we?" he asked. "Soon?"
"Almost at once," said Lupin. "We're just waiting for the all-clear."
"Where are we going? The borough?"
Harry asked hopefully.
"Not the burrow, no," said Lupin, motioning Harry toward the kitchen. The little knot of wizards followed, all still eyeing Harry curiously.
"Too risky. We've set up headquarters somewhere undetectable. It's taken a while."
Mad-Eye Moody was now sitting at the kitchen table, swigging from a hip flask, his magical eyes spinning in all directions, taking in the Dursleys' many labor-saving appliances.
"This is Alistair Moody, Harry," Lupin continued, pointing toward Moody.
"Yeah, I know," said Harry uncomfortably. It felt odd to be introduced to somebody he'd thought he'd known for a year.
"And this is Nymphadora."
"Don't call me Nymphadora, Remus," said the young witch with a shudder. "It's Tonks."
"Nymphadora Tonks, who prefers to be known by her surname only," finished Lupin.
"So would you if your fool of a mother had called you Nymphadora," muttered Tonks.
"And this is Kingsley Shacklebolt." He indicated the tall black wizard, who bowed.
"Elpheus Doge?"
The wheezy-voiced wizard nodded.
"Daedalus Diggle?"
"We've met before," squeaked the excitable Diggle, dropping his top hat.
"Emmeline Vance." A stately-looking witch in an emerald-green shawl inclined her head.
"Sturgis Podmore."
A square-jawed wizard with thick straw-colored hair winked.
"And Hestia Jones."
A pink-cheeked, black-haired witch waved from next to the toaster.
Harry inclined his head awkwardly at each of them as they were introduced. He wished they would look at something other than him. It was as though he'd suddenly been ushered on stage. He also wondered why so many of them were there.
"A surprising number of people volunteered to come and get you," said Lupin,
as though he had read Harry's mind. The corners of his mouth twitched slightly.
"Yeah, well, the more the better," said Moody darkly. "We're your guard, Potter."
"We're just waiting for the signal to tell us it's safe to set off," said Lupin, glancing out of the kitchen window. "We've got about 15 minutes.
"Very clean, aren't they, these muggles?"
said the witch called Tonks, who was looking around the kitchen with great interest.
"My dad's muggle-born, and he's a right old slob. I suppose it varies, just like with wizards."
Yeah, said Harry. "Look," he turned back to Lupin,
"what's going on? I haven't heard anything from anyone. What's Vol?"
Several of the witches and wizards made odd hissing noises.
Daedalus Diggle dropped his hat again, and Moody growled,
"Shut up."
"What?" said Harry.
"We're not discussing anything here. It's too risky," said Moody, turning his normal eye on Harry.
His magical eye remained pointing up at the ceiling.
"Damn it,"
he added angrily, putting a hand up to the magical eye.
"It keeps sticking, ever since that scum wore it."
And with a nasty squelching sound, much like a plunger being pulled from a sink, he popped out his eye.
"Mad-Eye, you do know that's disgusting, don't you?"
said Tonks conversationally.
"Get me a glass of water, would you, Harry?" asked Moody.
Harry crossed to the dishwasher, took out a clean glass and filled it with water at the sink, still watched eagerly by the band of wizards. Their relentless staring was starting to annoy him.
"Cheers,"
said Moody, when Harry handed him the glass. He dropped the magical eyeball into the water and prodded it up and down. The eye whizzed around, staring at them all in turn.
"I want 360 degrees visibility on the return journey."
"How are we getting wherever we're going?" Harry asked.
"Brooms," said Lupin. "Only way. You're too young to apparate. They'll be watching the flu network, and it's more than our life's worth to set up an unauthorized portkey."
"Remus says you're a good flyer,"
said Kingsley Shacklebolt in his deep voice.
"He's excellent," said Lupin, who was checking his watch. "Anyway, you'd better go and get packed, Harry. We want to be ready to go when the signal comes."
"I'll come and help you,"
said Tonks brightly. She followed Harry back into the hall and up the stairs, looking around with much curiosity and interest.
"Funny place," she said. "It's a bit too clean. Do you know what I mean? Bit unnatural." "Oh, this is better,"
she added as they entered Harry's bedroom and he turned on the light. His room was certainly much messier than the rest of the house. Confined to it for 4 days in a very bad mood, Harry had not bothered tidying up after himself. Most of the books he owned were strewn over the floor, where he'd tried to distract himself with each in turn and thrown it aside. Hedwig's cage needed cleaning out and was starting to smell, and his trunk lay open, revealing a jumbled mixture of muggle clothes and wizard's robes that had spilled onto the floor around it. Harry started picking up books and throwing them hastily into his trunk. Tonks paused at his open wardrobe to look critically at her reflection in the mirror on the inside of the door.
"You know, I don't think purple's really my colour,"
she said pensively, tugging at a lock of spiky hair.
"Do you think it makes me look a bit peaky?"
Said Harry, looking up at her over the top of Quidditch teams of Britain and Ireland.
"Yeah, it does,"
said Tonks decisively. She screwed up her eyes in a strained expression as though she was struggling to remember something. A second later, her hair had turned bubblegum pink.
"How did you do that?"
said Harry, gaping at her as she opened her eyes again.
"I'm a metamorph magus,"
she said, looking back at her reflection and turning her head so that she could see her hair from all directions.
"It means I can change my appearance at will,"
she added, spotting Harry's puzzled expression in the mirror behind her.
"I was born one. I got top marks in concealment and disguise during Auror training, without any study at all. It was great."
"You're an Auror?" said Harry, impressed.
Being a dark wizard catcher was the only career he'd ever considered after Hogwarts.
"Yeah," said Tonks, looking proud. "Kingsley is as well. He's a bit higher up than I am, though. I only qualified a year ago. Nearly failed on stealth and tracking. I'm dead clumsy. Did you hear me break that plate when we arrived downstairs?"
"Can you learn how to be a metamorph magus?" Harry asked her, straightening up, completely forgetting about packing. Tonks chuckled.
"Bet you wouldn't mind hiding that scar sometimes, eh?"
Her eyes found the lightning-shaped scar on Harry's forehead.
"No, I wouldn't mind," Harry mumbled, turning away. He did not like people staring at his scar.
"Well, you'll have to learn the hard way, I'm afraid," said Tonks. "Metamorph magi are really rare. They're born, not made. Most wizards need to use a wand or potions to change their appearance." "But we've got to get going, Harry. We're supposed to be packing,"
she added guiltily, looking around at all the mess on the floor.
"Oh, yeah," said Harry, grabbing up a few more books.
"Don't be stupid. It'll be much quicker if I..."
"Pack!"
cried Tonks, waving her wand in a long sweeping movement over the floor. Books, clothes, telescope and scales all soared into the air and flew pell-mell into the trunk.
"It's not very neat,"
said Tonks, walking over to the trunk and looking down at the jumble inside.
"My mum's got this knack of getting stuff to fit itself in neatly. She even gets the socks to fold themselves, but I've never mastered how she does it. It's a kind of flick."
She flicked her wand hopefully. One of Harry's socks gave a feeble sort of wiggle and flopped back on top of the mess within.
"Ah, well,"
said Tonks, slamming the trunk's lid shut.
"At least it's all in. That could do with a bit of cleaning, too."
"Scourgify!"
She pointed her wand at Hedwig's cage. A few feathers and droppings vanished.
"Well, that's a bit better. I've never quite got the hang of these sort of householdy spells. Right, got everything? Cauldron? Broom? Wow! A firebolt?"
Her eyes widened as they fell on the broomstick in Harry's right hand. It was his pride and joy, a gift from Sirius, an international standard broomstick.
"And I'm still riding a Comet 260, said Tonks enviously. "Ah, well. One still in your jeans? Both buttocks still on? Okay, let's go. Locomotor trunk!"
Harry's trunk rose a few inches into the air. Holding her wand like a conductor's baton, Tonks made it hover across the room and out of the door ahead of them, Hedwig's cage in her left hand. Harry followed her down the stairs carrying his broomstick. Back in the kitchen, Moody had replaced his eye, which was spinning so fast after its cleaning it made Harry feel sick. Kingsley Shacklebolt and Sturgis Podmore were examining the microwave, and Hestia Jones was laughing at a potato peeler she had come across while rummaging in the drawers. Lupin was sealing a letter addressed to the Dursleys.
"Excellent," said Lupin, looking up as Tonks and Harry entered. "We've got about a minute, I think. We should probably get out into the garden so we're ready. Harry,
I've left a letter telling your aunt and uncle not to worry.
They won't, said Harry.
That you're safe?
That'll just depress them.
And you'll see them next summer.
Do I have to?
Lupin smiled but made no answer.
Come here, boy, said Moody gruffly, beckoning Harry toward him with his wand. I need to disillusion you.
You need to what?
Said Harry nervously.
Disillusionment charm, said Moody, raising his wand. Lupin says you've got an invisibility cloak, but it won't stay on while we're flying, and this'll disguise you better. Here you go.
He rapped Harry hard on the top of the head, and Harry felt a curious sensation as though Moody had just smashed an egg there. Cold trickles seemed to be running down his body from the point the wand had struck.
Nice one, Mad-Eye, said Tonks appreciatively, staring at Harry's midriff.
Harry looked down at his body, or rather, what had been his body, for it didn't look anything like his anymore. It was not invisible. It had simply taken on the exact color and texture of the kitchen unit behind him. He seemed to have become a human chameleon.
Come on, said Moody, unlocking the back door with his wand.
They all stepped outside onto Uncle Vernon's beautifully kept lawn.
Clear night, grunted Moody, his magical eyes scanning the heavens. Could have done with a bit more cloud cover. Right, you, he barked at Harry. We're going to be flying in close formation. Tonks'll be right in front of you. Keep close on her tail. Lupin'll be covering you from below. I'm going to be behind you. The rest'll be circling us. We don't break ranks for anything. Got me? If one of us is killed...
Is that likely?
Harry asked apprehensively, but Moody ignored him.
The others keep flying. Don't stop. Don't break ranks. If they take out all of us and you survive, Harry, the rear guard are standing by to take over. Keep flying east and they'll join you.
Stop being so cheerful, Mad-Eye. He'll think we're not taking this seriously, said Tonks, as she strapped Harry's trunk and Hedwig's cage into a harness hanging from her broom.
I'm just telling the boy the plan, growled Moody. Our job's to deliver him safely to headquarters, and if we die in the attempt... No one's going to die, said Kingsley Shacklebolt in his deep, calming voice.
Mount your brooms! That's the first signal, said Lupin sharply, pointing into the sky. Far, far above them, a shower of bright red sparks had flared among the stars. Harry recognized them at once as wand sparks. He swung his right leg over his firebolt, gripped its handle tightly, and felt it vibrating very slightly, as though it was as keen as he was to be up in the air once more.
Second signal, let's go, said Lupin loudly, as more sparks, green this time, exploded high above them.
Harry kicked off hard from the ground. The cool night air rushed through his hair as the neat square gardens of Privet Drive fell away, shrinking rapidly into a patchwork of dark greens and blacks, and every thought of the ministry hearing was swept from his mind as though the rush of air had blown it out of his head. He felt as though his heart was going to explode with pleasure.
He was flying again,
flying away from Privet Drive as he'd been fantasizing about all summer.
He was going home.
For a few glorious moments, all his problems seemed to recede into nothing, insignificant in the vast, starry sky.
Hard left! Hard left! There's a muggle looking up!
Shouted Moody from behind him. Tonks swerved and Harry followed her, watching his trunk swinging wildly beneath her broom.
We need more height! Give it another quarter of a mile.
Harry's eyes watered in the chill as they soared upward. He could see nothing below now but tiny pinpricks of light that were car headlights and street lamps. Two of those tiny lights might belong to Uncle Vernon's car. The Dursleys would be heading back to their empty house right now, full of rage about the non-existent lawn competition. And Harry laughed aloud at the thought, though his voice was drowned by the flapping of the other's robes, the creaking of the harness holding his trunk and the cage, the whoosh of the wind in their ears as they sped through the air. He had not felt this alive in a month, or this happy.
"Bearing south!" shouted Mad-Eye. "Town ahead!"
They soared right, so that they did not pass directly over the glittering spider-web of lights below.
"Bear southeast and keep climbing! There's some low cloud ahead we can lose ourselves in," called Moody.
"We're not going through clouds," shouted Tonks angrily. "We'll get soaked, Mad-Eye."
Harry was relieved to hear her say this. His hands were growing numb on the firebolt's handle.
He wished he had thought to put on a coat. He was starting to shiver. They altered their course every now and then according to Mad-Eye's instructions. Harry's eyes were screwed up against the rush of icy wind that was starting to make his ears ache. He could remember being this cold on a broom only once before, during the Quidditch match against Hufflepuff in his third year, which had taken place in a storm. The guard around him was circling continuously like giant birds of prey. Harry lost track of time. He wondered how long they'd been flying. It felt like an hour, at least.
"Turning southwest," yelled Moody. "We want to avoid the motorway."
Harry was now so chilled that he thought longingly for a moment of the snug, dry interiors of the cars streaming along below. Then, even more longingly, of traveling by flue powder. It might be uncomfortable to spin around in fireplaces, but it was at least warm in the flames. Kingsley Shacklebolt swooped around him, ball pate, an earring gleaming slightly in the moonlight. Now Emmeline Vance was on his right, her wand out, her head turning left and right. Then she too swooped over him, to be replaced by Sturgis Podmore.
"We ought to double back for a bit, just to make sure we're not being followed," Moody shouted.
"Are you mad, Mad-Eye?"
Tonks screamed from the front.
"We're all frozen to our brooms. If we keep going off course, we're not going to get there until next week. We're nearly there now."
"Time to start the descent,"
came Lupin's voice.
"Follow Tonks, Harry."
Harry followed Tonks into a dive. They were heading for the largest collection of lights he had yet seen, a huge, sprawling, crisscrossing mass, glittering in lines and grids, interspersed with patches of deepest black. Lower and lower they flew until Harry could see individual headlights and street lamps, chimneys and television aerials. He wanted to reach the ground very much, though he felt sure that someone would have to unfreeze him from his broom.
"Here we go,"
called Tonks, and a few seconds later she had landed. Harry touched down right behind her and dismounted on a patch of unkempt grass in the middle of a small square. Tonks was already unbuckling Harry's trunk. Shivering, Harry looked around. The grimy fronts of the surrounding houses were not welcoming. Some of them had broken windows, glimmering dully in the light from the street lamps. Paint was peeling from many of the doors, and heaps of rubbish lay outside several sets of front steps.
"Where are we?" Harry asked.
But Lupin said quietly,
"In a minute."
Moody was rummaging in his cloak, his gnarled hands clumsy with cold.
"Got it,"
he muttered, raising what looked like a silver cigarette lighter into the air and clicking it. The nearest street lamp went out with a pop. He clicked the unlighter again. The next lamp went out. He kept clicking until every lamp in the square was extinguished, and the only light in the square came from curtained windows and the sickle moon overhead.
"Borrowed it from Dumbledore," growled Moody, pocketing the put-outer. "That'll take care of any muggles looking out of the window, see? Now, come on, quick."
He took Harry by the arm and led him from the patch of grass, across the road and onto the pavement. Lupin and Tonks followed, carrying Harry's trunk between them, the rest of the guard, all with their wands out, flanking them. The muffled pounding of a stereo was coming from an upper window in the nearest house. A pungent smell of rotting rubbish came from the pile of bulging bin bags just inside the broken gate.
"Here,"
Moody muttered, thrusting a piece of parchment toward Harry's disillusioned hand and holding his lit wand close to it so as to illuminate the writing.
"Read quickly and memorize."
Harry looked down at the piece of paper. The narrow handwriting was vaguely familiar. It said, "The headquarters of the Order of the Phoenix may be found at number 12 Grimald Place, London." Chapter 4. Number 12 Grimald Place. "What's the order of the..." Harry began.
"Not here, boy," snarled Moody. "Wait till we're inside."
He pulled a piece of parchment out of Harry's hand and set fire to it with his wand tip. As the message curled into flames and floated to the ground, Harry looked around at the houses again. They were standing outside number 11. He looked to the left and saw number 10. To the right, however, was number 13.
"But where's..." "Think about what you've just memorized," said Lupin quietly.
Harry thought, and no sooner had he reached the part about number 12, Grimald Place, than a battered door emerged out of nowhere between numbers 11 and 13, followed swiftly by dirty walls and grimy windows. It was as though an extra house had been inflated, pushing those on either side out of its way. Harry gaped at it. The stereo in number 11 thudded on. Apparently the muggles inside hadn't even felt anything.
"Come on, hurry!"
growled Moody, prodding Harry in the back. Harry walked up the worn stone steps, staring at the newly materialized door. Its black paint was shabby and scratched. The silver door knocker was in the form of a twisted serpent. There was no keyhole or letterbox. Lupin pulled out his wand and tapped the door once. Harry heard many loud, metallic clicks and what sounded like the clatter of a chain. The door creaked open.
"Get in, quick, Harry," Lupin whispered. "But don't go far inside and don't touch anything."
Harry stepped over the threshold into the almost total darkness of the hall. He could smell damp, dust, and a sweetish, rotting smell. The place had the feeling of a derelict building. He looked over his shoulder and saw the others filing in behind him. Lupin and Tonks carrying his trunk and Hedwig's cage. Moody was standing on the top step and releasing the balls of light the put-outer had stolen from the street lamps. They flew back to their bulbs, and the square beyond glowed momentarily with orange light before Moody limped inside and closed the front door, so that the darkness in the hall became complete.
"Here!"
He rapped Harry hard over the head with his wand. Harry felt as though something hot was trickling down his back this time, and knew that the disillusionment charm must have lifted.
"Now stay still, everyone, while I give us a bit of light in here," Moody whispered.
The others' hushed voices were giving Harry an odd feeling of foreboding. It was as though they'd just entered the house of a dying person. He heard a soft hissing noise, and then old-fashioned gas lamps sputtered into life all along the walls, casting a flickering, insubstantial light over the peeling wallpaper and threadbare carpet of a long, gloomy hallway where a cobwebby chandelier glimmered overhead and age-blackened portraits hung crooked on the walls. Harry heard something scuttling behind the baseboard. Both the chandelier and the candelabra on a rickety table nearby were shaped like serpents. There were hurried footsteps, and Ron's mother, Mrs. Weasley, emerged from a door at the far end of the hall. She was beaming in welcome as she hurried toward them, though Harry noticed that she was rather thinner and paler than she had been last time he had seen her.
"Oh, Harry, it's lovely to see you," she whispered,
pulling him into a rib-cracking hug, before holding him at arm's length and examining him critically.
"You're looking peaky. You need fading up, but you'll have to wait a bit for dinner, I'm afraid."
She turned to the gang of wizards behind him and whispered urgently,
"He's just arrived. The meeting started."
The wizards behind Harry all made noises of interest and excitement and began filing past Harry towards the door through which Mrs. Weasley had just come. Harry made to follow Lupin, but Mrs. Weasley held him back.
"No, Harry, the meeting's only for members of the Order. Ron and Hermione are upstairs. You can wait with them until the meeting's over, and then we'll have dinner. And keep your voice down in the hall,"
she added in an urgent whisper.
"Why?" "I don't want to wake anything up." "What do you mean? I'll explain later. I've got to hurry. I'm supposed to be at the meeting. I'll just show you where you're sleeping."
Pressing her fingers to her lips, she led him on tiptoes past a pair of long, moth-eaten curtains, behind which Harry supposed there must be another door, and, after skirting a large umbrella stand that looked as though it had been made from a severed troll's leg, they started up the dark staircase, passing a row of shrunken heads mounted on plaques on the wall. A closer look showed Harry that the heads belonged to house elves. All of them had the same rather snout-like nose. Harry's bewilderment deepened with every step he took. What on earth were they doing in a house that looked as though it belonged to the darkest of wizards?
"Mrs. Weasley, why, Ron and Hermione will explain everything, dear. I've really got to dash,"
Mrs. Weasley whispered distractedly.
"There."
They had reached the second landing.
"You're the door on the right. I'll call you when it's over."
And she hurried off downstairs again. Harry crossed the dingy landing, turned the bedroom doorknob, which was shaped like a serpent's head, and opened the door. He caught a brief glimpse of a gloomy, high-ceilinged, twin-bedded room. Then there was a loud, twittering noise, followed by an even louder shriek, and his vision was completely obscured by a large quantity of very bushy hair. Hermione had thrown herself onto him in a hug that nearly knocked him flat, while Ron's tiny owl, Pigwidgeon, zoomed excitedly round and round their heads.
"Harry! Ron, he's here! Harry's here! We didn't hear you arrive. Oh, how are you? Are you all right? Have you been furious with us? I bet you have. I know our letters were useless, but we couldn't tell you anything. Dumbledore made us swear we wouldn't. Oh, we've got so much to tell you, and you've got to tell us, the Dementors. When we heard, and that ministry hearing, it's just outrageous. I've looked it all up. They can't expel you. They just can't. There's provision in the decree for the restriction of underage sorcery for the use of magic in life-threatening situations.
Let him breathe, Hermione, said Ron, grinning, closing the door behind Harry. He seemed to have grown several more inches during their month apart, making him taller and more gangly-looking than ever, though the long nose, bright red hair, and freckles were the same. Hermione, still beaming, let go of Harry, but before she could say another word, there was a soft whooshing sound, and something white soared from the top of a dark wardrobe and landed gently on Harry's shoulder.
Hedwig!
The snowy owl clicked her beak and nibbled his ear affectionately as Harry stroked her feathers.
"She's been in a right state," said Ron. "Pecked us half to death when she brought your last letter. Look at this."
He showed Harry the index finger of his right hand, which sported a half-healed but clearly deep cut.
"Oh, yeah," Harry said. "Sorry about that, but I wanted answers, you know." "We wanted to give them to you, mate," said Ron. "Hermione was going spare. She kept saying you'd do something stupid if you were stuck all on your own without news. But Dumbledore made us..."
"Swear not to tell me," said Harry. "Yeah, Hermione's already said." The warm glow that had flared inside him at the sight of his two best friends was extinguished as something icy flooded the pit of his stomach. All of a sudden, after yearning to see them for a solid month, he felt he would rather run, and Hermione left him alone. There was a strained silence in which Harry stroked Hedwig automatically, not looking at either of the others.
"He seemed to think it was best," said Hermione rather breathlessly. "Dumbledore, I mean."
"Right," said Harry. He noticed that her hands too bore the marks of Hedwig's beak, and found that he was not at all sorry.
"I think he thought you were safest with the Muggles," Ron began.
"Yeah?" said Harry, raising his eyebrows. "Have either of you been attacked by Dementors this summer?"
"Well, no. But that's why he's had people from the Order of the Phoenix tailing you all the time."
Harry felt a great jolt in his guts, as though he had just missed a step going downstairs. So everyone had known he was being followed except him. "Didn't work that well, though, did it?" said Harry, doing his utmost to keep his voice even. "Had to look after myself after all, didn't I?"
"He was so angry," said Hermione in an almost awestruck voice. "Dumbledore, we saw him. When he found out Mundungus had left before his shift had ended, he was scary."
"Well, I'm glad he left," Harry said coldly. "If he hadn't, I wouldn't have done magic, and Dumbledore would probably have left me at Privet Drive all summer."
Aren't you worried about the Ministry of Magic hearing?" said Hermione quietly.
"No," Harry lied defiantly. He walked away from them, looking around, with Hedwig nestled contentedly on his shoulder. But this room was not likely to raise his spirits. It was dank and dark. A blank stretch of canvas in an ornate picture frame was all that relieved the bareness of the peeling walls, and as Harry passed it, he thought he heard someone lurking out of sight, snigger. "So why's Dumbledore being so keen to keep me in the dark?" Harry asked, still trying hard to keep his voice casual. "Did you, bother to ask him at all?" He glanced up just in time to see them exchanging a look that told him he was behaving just as they had feared he would. It did nothing to improve his temper.
"We told Dumbledore we wanted to tell you what was going on," said Ron. "We did, mate, but he's really busy now. We've only seen him twice since we came here, and he didn't have much time. He just made us swear not to tell you important stuff when we wrote. He said the owls might be intercepted."
"He could still have kept me informed if he'd wanted to," Harry said shortly. "You're not telling me he doesn't know ways to send messages without owls?"
Hermione glanced at Ron and then said, "I thought that too, but he didn't want you to know anything."
"Maybe he thinks I can't be trusted," said Harry, watching their expressions.
"Don't be thick,"
said Ron, looking highly disconcerted. "Or that I can't take care of myself."
Of course he doesn't think that, said Hermione anxiously.
So how come I have to stay at the Dursleys while you two get to join in everything that's going on here? Said Harry, the words tumbling over one another in a rush, his voice growing louder with every word. How come you two are allowed to know everything that's going on?
We're not,
Ron interrupted. Mum won't let us near the meetings. She says we're too young. But before he knew it, Harry was shouting.